Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm back and would like to offer a huge thanks to Bev Capshaw, who hosted the show in my absence during the last two Wednesdays. She delivered excellent interviews with Rick Yoakum, executive director of the Humane Society of Manatee County, on the first Wednesday, then Aaron Weyer from Tampa Bay Beagle Rescue last Wednesday, with both shows rounded out by music, comedy, and announcements. If you missed one or both of those great programs, be sure to listen on the WMNF archives. Meanwhile, my guest today is Ed Stewart, co-founder, president, and CEO of the Performing Arts Animal Welfare Society, or PAWS. PAWS is a pioneer and organization in rescuing and providing humane sanctuary to wild animals, particularly victims of the exotic and performing animal trade. These animals include tigers, bears, and elephants, all of whom live at ARC 2000, the 2,300-acre sanctuary PAWS operates in San Andreas, California. Stewart and his longtime partner, the late Pat Derby, an eloquent dynamo who was not to be trifled with, blazed a trail in animal rescue, welfare, education, legislation, and more. This year, PAWS marks its 40th anniversary. With that anniversary in mind, I invited Ed Stewart back on the show with the intention of asking him to comment on key milestones over these four decades, reflect on pivotal challenges and how he and Pat and others overcame them, other developments that strike him as central to what PAWS has become. I'll also ask that he look ahead a little bit in various ways to PAWS' future. We'll have that conversation with Ed Stewart in a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, coming up later in today's program, I'll speak with George Heinrich, the field biologist and environmental educator who specializes in Florida reptiles, who's slated to deliver a lecture at Brooker Creek Preserve Environmental Education Center on April 6th, entitled Conserving Wildlife and Wildlands, Building a Career in Herpetology. We'll hear more about that lecture when George Heinrich joins us a bit later in the show. Right now, though, let's talk rescue, sanctuary, elephants, and more with Ed Stewart of PAWS as they mark their 40th anniversary. With a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Ed Stewart back to Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Ed.
Hey, good morning, Duncan. How are you doing?
Doing really well. Happy 40th anniversary, and thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals.
You bet. Always glad to talk to you.
That's great. Now, 40 years is a long time to be doing anything, really. So let's start by talking a bit about those earliest years. What were you and Pat doing like right as that beginning of that 40-year span?
Well, Pat had rescued animals her whole life. And she had a handful of animals that we cared for. But there were some horrible instances down in Hollywood with animals that we heard about that were injured and dying and being beaten for movies and shows. So, you know, one of our friends who was involved in the legislature in California said, you need to get some legislation passed. And so we did a kind of a 180 and decided we were going to be advocates for the animals. We never really planned on having a sanctuary. That wasn't wasn't in the plan, but obviously that happened, and very successfully. But at the beginning, we were just going to be advocates and try to protect the animals that were working basically in Hollywood at that time. So got some legislation passed, formed our organization, and that's how we took off.
So, you know, that's, I'm not sure everybody would realize how early on the legislation part of the array of things that PAWS has done and specialized in over the years. So that sounds like that was really, from the get-go, legislation was part of the part of your efforts.
Right. And we've assisted on a lot of, you know, everybody kind of circles the wagons in the humane organizations when it's needed. But we were, you know, since then we've sponsored legislation in California to stop ivory trade, which has been very successful. And also the bullhook ban, which is an elephant associated with elephant training. A bullhook is the sharp stick that, you know, people for 5,000 years have guided elephants with, and it's abusive.
Yeah,
they're hit, they're poked, they're prodded, they're pulled, and so we had that ban in California. That was one of our biggest legislative efforts, and we did it with the Oakland Zoo and the Humane Society of the United States.
And that's critical in so many ways because, you know, if someone can't use a bullhook, that means, among other things, that circuses and other performing entities can't really have elephants.
Well, that was kind of the strategy. You know, we could have tried to ban elephants from coming into California, but that was too general. And you know, Pat had enough experience, and I had enough experience at that time with animals and elephants specifically, and we knew they couldn't just walk in to nobody could walk into California with with an elephant and no bullhook. The only reason elephants perform is because there's somebody standing there with a threat. And sometimes, you know, in the old days, the trainers were whips and bullhooks and, you know, right out in front of people, they would hit and prod the elephants. After we started trying to open people's eyes to it, you know, then they started to hide it. And act like they were, you know, they weren't using the bullhook, but they still were. All an elephant has to do is see a bullhook, and it's frightening enough to do an act. It's really sad. And at times, it's, you know, the one thing that has happened in the last 40 years that I see is people had no idea what was going on with circus animals, movie animals, roadside zoo animals, pets, tigers, things like that. And, you know, we weren't going to beat anybody over the head with our ideas, but we did want them to know what the reality was for those animals that had to endure that kind of lifestyle. And that has been an incredible success. I mean, the Humane Society used to hire circuses as a fundraiser when we started because they had no idea that there was abuse in a circus or a carnival. And, you know, now that would be the last thing they would ever think about doing. So it's really evolved in the last 40 years. But there's a lot of work to do.
Yeah, well, that is a measure of how much people, you know, really didn't know and how I guess it was, you know, so effectively marketed with Ringling Brothers in particular that, you know, like you say, if a Humane Society was hiring a circus for entertainment purposes. That just shows you how far we've traveled and the level of, I mean, ignorance, I mean, reasonable ignorance. There's no reason anybody can know until they know, but, it's kind of shocking to look back and think about that now. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah. You're right. People were innocent until you know, until somebody shows you or tells you what's going on. Ironically, kids know immediately. You know, they can walk into an animal facility, a zoo, or any place, I think they immediately think there's something wrong, and they have to be taught that it's okay. You know, don't worry about it. It's educational and it's conservation, whatever the facility is putting out. But I think I think kids know immediately that something's wrong if an animal is in a cage or an animal is being hit with a bullhook. You know, you kind of get a little thick skin later on, and you just accept it, I guess. But you know, I think the kids are the key. You know, they're sharp and they know.
Yeah. Well, also, too, on, you know, I guess for better or worse, and certainly for worse in this case, people that still do train and use elephants have become super slick about concealing the bullhook or the use of the bullhook so that it's if you, I mean, just
yeah,
go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, you're right. And, you know, but the chains, you know, it's hard to move elephants around without having them chained up. So elephants in the circus are really, the numbers are dwindling because the audience, you know, the audience doesn't want to see it. You know, they don't want to see an elephant come out in a headdress and stand on their back legs. And, so I give credit to society for, you know, I mean, 40 years is a long time, but it's pretty quick to evolve from total acceptance to absolute no acceptance. And that's pretty much what's happened.
Yeah, and as a side note, have you had any occasion to go to or at least hear directly about the animal-free ringling circus that now is touring around?
No, but animal-free circuses, we have always promoted, you know.
For sure.
We suggested that, you know, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
That Cirque du Soleil came out just about at the same time we started, and we used them as an example of incredible human feats and, you know, beautiful movement. And no animals, and they were drawing, you know, full houses everywhere they go, and they still are. But you know, the old animal trainer community just is, you know, they didn't want to give up, and I can see that. You know, a lot of those people were families that had passed this on from generation to generation, and you know, there are a lot of industries where it's kind of hard to let it go, even though you know there's a problem with it.
Yeah.
But things have changed, you know. I mean, there are a lot of pretty nice people that, you know, were on the opposite side. And so it's good to see. It's great to see Ringling with a circus that doesn't have animals. I mean, I might even go.
Yeah, well, that's why I wonder if you might have even caught a performance at this point, just because.
No, not yet, but yeah. But we.
You're not averse to it. It sounds like, though.
No, a human circus with no animals at all.
Yeah,
I'm 100%.
That's more like it. Yeah,
yeah, sure. That's what a circus should be. You know.
Yeah,
it's not, and it wasn't an American tradition. You know, all the people who wanted to think it's an American tradition. It's not an American tradition at all. It was brought over from Europe and so it had nothing to do with being an American going to the circus. It really had, you know, it was just an import, and, you know, it's over.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's over with the animals, or very close.
For sure. Well, a lot of that was the marketing of, hey, a circus is like kind of mom and apple pie and very American thing to do, and come on out to the arena
I grew up in Chicago and Cleveland and Detroit, and we, you know, at the first circus protest I ever went to and held a sign, somebody threw a taco at me, and and, you know, it was a very hard, it was very hard not to get aggressive, you know, but it was ugly at the beginning. It was, I give everybody who stood out in front of a circus a lot of credit, because it was, you know, it was uncomfortable and painful, and nobody really wanted to do that, but they did want people to walk up and at least take the brochure and see what we thought.
Yeah, and so often those of us who did stand out there would find that, sure, some people like had already bought their tickets or just thought you were just kind of some annoying kook, but many people actually would listen, and some, you know, even if they already had bought tickets, would turn around and head to the parking lot. So you felt like even with little pockets, like, okay, we're going to get somewhere. It's still going to take a long time before this thing really gets reversed, but little indications like that made you think, okay, we can get there. I don't know how long it's going to take, but we just keep doing this and something.
Yeah. Little victories. And then in our case, we, you know, were heavily involved in elephant rescue and also tiger bear, a lot of different species. And we had animals, how we were housing animals and trying to give them some dignity and respect for the rest of their lives, and when they've come from just the opposite and a lot, sometimes horrible abuse. But so we had a constant reminder every day we woke up and worked to take care of our animals. You know, we worked hard to stop the problem. You know, it would have been much easier for PAWS to just take the animals, send out mailers to people and say, please send me money to take care of this cute elephant. You know, that's one way of doing it. And the other way is to get out in the arena and get bloodied and fight for the animals and try to stop the problem. You know, I think too many places who are housing animals don't do anything to stop the problem. And that's that kind of, you know, that was our focus.
Really
at the beginning was to level the playing field at least and make our point heard. And Pat Derby was like the genius spokesperson for anti-circus movement in the U.S. And she was brilliant. You know, her father was a English literature professor at Cambridge. So she was, you know, I'm from Cleveland. She's from Cambridge. It didn't really match up, but
we
were together for 37 years, and I think we made a pretty good dent.
I'll say. Well, let me just, for those who might just be tuning in, let me just introduce you, and then I want to come back to Pat since you brought her up. It's a good time to chat a little bit further about her. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is Ed Stewart, co-founder, president and CEO of the Performing Animal Welfare Society, or PAWS. PAWS blazes a trail in animal rescue, welfare, education, legislation, and more. And this year marks its 40th anniversary. If you have a question for Ed or would like to offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So it's just over 11 years, I guess, since we lost the extraordinary Pat Derby. For those listening who weren't fortunate enough to know her or even just see her in action, describe a little bit more about Pat and what made her such a formidable opponent for those who would abuse or otherwise mistreat animals.
Well, it was our entire life. You know, I mean, we never looked at what we did at PAWS when Pat and I started, and we were the only ones working. And we never looked at it like a job. It was like a mission. It was like a battle, like a war. And all we did, when I look back on it, was strategize and try to figure out ways of, you know, getting our message out. And I mean, she was, you know, you put her in front of a television camera or a reporter, and she would explain exactly what needed to be said. You know, she was perfect at that. And so, you know, it was something that consumed her and me at that time. And, you know, so she was steeped in it, you know, just immersed in our project. And so, and on top of that, brilliant, I mean, had the best vocabulary I've ever, you know, heard in my life. She, you could start any classic poem, give her one line, and she would finish it. She read everything. She knew music. She was, I mean, just the most well-rounded educationally person that I've ever known. And on top of that, she was 5'1" and redheaded, and you didn't mess with her.
Yeah. No, that's for sure. I mean, like I said earlier in the intro, you know, totally a dynamo and not to be trifled with. And like, I remember, you know, early on when I got to know her a little bit, and she seemed to support the idea of the radio show. And so she came on a few times, but one time I made the mistake of being a little too casual or glib about a zoo reference. And she scolded me right then and there, live on the air on my own radio show. But I mean, I thought, well, that's Pat on the one hand. And also, like, I learned a lesson, because I thought more carefully the next time that kind of situation came along. So
That's... Well, join the club, Duncan.
Yeah, sure.
I caught a little bit of that myself.
I'm guessing. Yeah. But on the other hand, I remember one of the first times, and we'll come back to ARC 2000 in a moment or two. But I remember one of the first times I was lucky enough to visit there, and Pat walked out, and it was either Mara or 71, one of the two elephants initially, I guess, came running towards her, like those videos you see where a serviceman, you know, soldier or some kind returns, and the lab or the dog, whatever, the family dog, runs bonkers to greet that person. This elephant ran and greeted Pat the same way, and I thought, holy smoke, that is powerful.
Yeah. She had, you know, she was also an actress in on Broadway and touring shows. So she had a great voice, and I think that was the strong point. I mean, somehow when she was around, no matter what was going on, if you had an issue, a sick elephant, anything that was happening, when you heard her voice, even us, even me, and I heard it constantly for 37 years, you would sort of think that everything was going to be okay. And I think the animals had the same feeling.
Yeah.
You know, because she was, her voice was so distinct, and she, her appearance too. I mean, she, when she would show up, I mean, some of the animals, I mean, we have an elephant now who's the oldest African elephant in North America. And she came out of the out of a zoo. And, you know, she was very aggressive and very afraid of the other elephants. And it was, you know, sad, her whole situation and the way she responded to the other elephants. She would, when she first saw them, she would crawl on the ground to get away from them. And that's not elephant behavior. It's just sad. And so anyway, Pat spent years with her, and she just responded to Pat. You know, she was extremely dangerous with people, but Pat could get up close to her and talk to her and stay with her and spent months and months and years. And now she's the oldest one in North America, and had a totally different attitude about elephants, of the other elephants. She blended in with all the other elephants that we've ever had. And it's all due to Pat's nurturing, you know, when this elephant was going through some extreme mental stress, you know.
Yeah. What elephant is that, Ed?
That's Lulu.
Okay. And how old is she at this point?
She's 58.
Wow.
And... which, you know, it's kind of a point we like to make, that 58 for captivity is extremely old. In the U.S., I think the average age for an African elephant like Lulu is 38 years old. And that's not right. You know, they in Africa, they give birth when they're 59, 60 years old.
Yeah.
You know, they live a long time, and they live a healthy life. And when they're not healthy, they pass away. They get their last set of teeth in their 40s. Out of six, they get six sets throughout their life. They get their last set in their 40s, and it should last them at least 20 years. And they're dying before they even get their last set. And that's just a comment on captivity.
Yeah.
You know, what I can't understand is why people, and people that I know, and people that are friends, you know, want to breed elephants in captivity. It just doesn't make any sense to me. You know they're going to live a deprived life. You know that they're probably going to die young. They're going to have problems that are due to captivity. And, you know, this whole education, conservation sort of cloud that's around the whole professional, especially in zoos and theme parks, world, they, you know, when they started zoos in this country, there were 27 million elephants in Africa, wild elephants, 27 million. With all of their efforts and education and conservation, the number has gone from 27 million to 500,000. So the business model isn't working. You know,
yeah.
Putting an elephant in a cage is not doing anything for conservation. Politics, you know, unfortunately, politics and economics drive, you know, animal habitat. And nobody's ever put an elephant back into the wild from a birth in the United States or any zoo in the world.
Yeah.
So it's just not working. But for amusement, it's a great business model. You know, people want to think they're doing something noble, taking their kid to see an elephant behind a fence. I just think it's a bad education. You know, if you walk in the woods around here, you can see a mountain lion occasionally. You have a totally different feeling when there's no fence in between you and the mountain lion. If you put it in a cage, you know, there's just not the level of respect that you should have for it.
Yeah, the whole equation changes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's talk. We already have a little bit about rescue. That's a longstanding, obviously, key pillar of the PAWS operation. I mean, in contrast to places that rescue dogs and cats and so on, an organization that rescues bears and tigers and lions and elephants obviously has to grapple with a whole different set of challenges. Can you recall some early rescues that were striking for one reason or another, even if it's just a matter of learning, you know, what to do the next time a little bit differently or better?
Yeah. I mean, you know, our situation, especially in the early days, was, you know, the animals would be like stranded on the freeway somewhere. You know, I remember some that came through California, a little show. It was just horrible. And we complained to the fish and wildlife people, and they, you know, agreed, but they just wanted to get these people out of the state. And we said that they are going to go belly up, and somebody's going to have to do something. So they did. They got up to Washington State, went belly up. They had two lions, two female lions, African lions, and a jaguar and two bears. And they were on the side of the road with nowhere to go. Luckily, the zoo in Seattle took, for a short time, took some of them and a place across in Sequim, Washington, you know, housed some for a while. But we had to build something and go up and get them. And I had to take a ferry with all the lions and jaguars and bears on the ferry. And I mean, no wonder I look like I do right now after that kind of stress. But those days were like the Wild West. And you just wanted to get them back and get them secure.
Yeah.
And get them comfortable and try to build something as nice as you could for them. You know, now we have a beautiful place. It's 2,300 acres, and it was some of the prettiest property in California, really. And So we have, you know, we planned it and built it big in the first place. But really, the key to animal rescue is stop the problem. You got to turn off the faucet. You know, you can't have animals just showing up and showing up and showing up. And that was one of our missions. That was one of our goals, is to stop, to shut the faucet off. This stuff with the Tiger King and those are the kind of people, you know, if anybody watched that, those are the kind of people we've dealt with for 40 years. And that wasn't a surprise to us to see people on drugs and with firearms and domestic violence and all the rest of, you know, there's always something else going on when somebody has a tiger chained up in their backyard. You know, it's so sad, and the tiger is the one that has to endure it.
Yeah, there seems like there's always something, like the Tiger King, even if it's not nearly as high profile. I remember when I was still living in Southern California, there was this place in Colton, California, that had like just a slew of tigers and in a ramshackle setup. And
You know what? Duncan, that was my next story.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Well, sorry, I didn't mean to step on that. No reason. I just remember going out, because there were some of us who, once it was taken over, and I think before they took some or all the tigers up to Paws, to your place, people still had to care for them and feed them. And it was so frightening, because the chain link fence and stuff was weak, and so they would come and they were starved, and, you know, you thought, I think they're going to come through the fence at any moment. It was just like, oh my God, this
exactly, is... Exactly. Yeah. I didn't know you were there, but that was the hardest thing we've ever done. I mean, we have a bull elephant who's 10 and a half feet tall and weighs 16,000 pounds. He was hard to deal with and hard to move and hard to acclimate. He's doing great now, but...
Oh, good.
But we took 39 tigers out of Colton, and that was the hardest thing that I ever did in my life, is try to design an enclosure for 39 tigers that were fighting each other. If you remember that, they were fighting, they were scarred up on their nose. They were ill. It was like a MASH unit, you know, when we went in there and tried to figure out how in the heck to move 39 tigers. So that was about 2004. And that was the hardest thing that we Paws ever did. And it really went unnoticed, you know. I mean, and the reason we did that, had to do that, is because the regulatory agencies didn't do their job. They didn't inspect this guy, and they didn't keep control. And they hadn't inspected him for 9 years. And it's easy to go from 10 tigers to 150, because they can breathe if you press them 3 or 4 times in a year. They should be breeding in the wild once every 2 years, or maybe every 3 years, not 4 times a year.
Yeah.
But it was a mess. They had 58 dead babies in the freezer down there. There were a total of 90 dead tigers when they finally went in there and saw how bad it was. It was a disgrace. And, you know, we took the animals. It cost a fortune, you know, to take care of them for so long, because there were so many problems that they had. And it's hard to take, you know, 39 chihuahuas.
Yeah, right.
500 pound tigers was, and I remember when Pat agreed to take them, it was like I almost fell over. I thought, my God, we don't have enough resources for this, but somehow we got through it.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you always kind of find a way. It's like another problem to solve, another gigantic, scary puzzle. But it sounds like you guys always find some way to get there, even if it's overwhelming at the time, which it often is.
Yeah, and I have to say, the people who have helped us, our supporters over the years, are so loyal and so good, and there are a lot in Florida that are, you know, I we you know, we were always kind of a small organization. You know, we started as a ma and pa, you know, just like a lot of them. And when people sent donations to us, you know, we didn't just take it as, you know, casually. You know, every single one that came in, we were, especially at the beginning, we were just overwhelmed, you know, with gratitude. And we still are.
Yeah. Well, along those lines, Ed, let's talk a little bit more just briefly about R2000, because that's the incredible sanctuary you're referring to that's in Northern California and the 2,300 acres. And so just not necessarily every animal there, but can you just give a little overview of, obviously we've talked about some elephants that live there, and what other animals kind of currently are living at R2000?
Well, we have, we still have tigers, bears. There are a few animals on the horizon that I can't talk about. You know, a lot of what the animals we get come from court cases and their evidence, and it's sort of an undercover confiscation by the authorities. So there are a couple that are in the works.
Yeah.
But we just took a little bobcat that came in that, you know, there's no history on this bobcat, and she's skittish, and she has a beautiful place to live now. But you know, then we have a couple of monkeys, you know, capuchin monkeys that we've had for 30 years, I think.
Wow.
And they started at our old sanctuary, and we moved them up a year ago, and they're doing great. And then an occasional emu comes through, and the county always, you know, they don't have anywhere to put it, so we've taken emu. And the elephants are, you know, we have a lot of elderly elephants.
Yeah.
You know, every elephant we have is over their life expectancy by quite a bit.
How many elephants currently there, Ed?
Seven.
Yeah,
seven.
Okay, that's what I thought. Yeah,
yeah, two bulls, and the rest are females. But the, you know, you were talking about Mara. At the beginning, Mara was the first elephant we ever were involved with. And she was at a little, you know, her mother was killed, her whole herd was killed in South Africa, in Kruger National Park, by the government. And it was a culling operation where they would just shoot an entire family of elephants because they determined there were too many elephants, where we might determine there are too many people encroaching on their space, but they shot her entire herd and then brought her into captivity, and she was by herself and shuffled around, and she was at a zoo, tiny zoo in San Jose, California, and the people who ran the zoo were selling her to a circus in Mexico. And they had trained her, they chained her. The first time Pat and I saw Mara, she was chained up, and the owner of the circus or the zoo was using a bullhook on her. And we thought, oh my God, you know, we've got to do something. Yeah. And the people in San Jose galvanized and mobilized. And so we didn't have a place to put her. But we flew her to Florida and put her into a group that was in Ocala, near Ocala.
Mm.
And with the understanding that if anything ever happened to the herd there, the group that had come in from Zimbabwe, it was a wild, a whole nother, it's like a book. But she stayed there for a couple of years. And then they dispersed the elephants. They started selling off the elephants, and we went back and got her. And so we've been responsible for Mara for 40 years.
Wow.
And she's the most spoiled elephant that we've ever had.
I'm sure.
I have nobody to blame but myself.
Yeah, I was going to say, and rightly so, probably, given what she's been through before.
And she deserves it.
Yeah.
She deserves it.
Yeah.
She is so amazing. So now she's like 45 years old, and she you know, healthy and strong. And I think we have a lot of hills on our property, and I think going up and down the mountains is really good for their overall fitness. And I, you know, right now the grass is up to their knees, and they're eating grass, and it's, you know, you live for moments where you, when you drive by and you see the elephants doing what they would be doing if they hadn't been captured and brought into captivity.
Yeah, elephants being able to be elephants, basically.
Right. You know, we have an elephant named Prince who sleeps on the side of the hill every day in the sunshine. And when you see that, you know, you feel really good about it, about giving him a home. But every other time you drive by, you think, God, why are these guys behind a fence, even at a sanctuary, even with respect? Why are they? They're victims. I mean, any animal that you go to see anywhere, at a sanctuary, at a zoo, at a circus, at a roadside zoo, they're victims. They should not be behind the fence. There's no reason for captivity for almost any animal. And I think people are starting to look at it like it's not as entertaining as it used to be to see animals in a cage. But, you know, at our place, it's a big cage. It's huge, but there's a fence.
Yeah.
And there's no state of the art keeping a wild animal closed up.
So, Ed, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, but I'd be curious to know, like, what does it cost? What's the annual cost to feed and care for, like, let's say, one of the elephants there?
One of the elephants, I think we've figured it out to be about $70,000 a year.
Wow.
For a healthy elephant.
Yeah. Yeah. And some need more medical care, it sounds like, than
Some need some medication, and so... Yeah, it adds up. You know, that's including insurance, prorated insurance and feed. And, yeah, this is a good time of the year because they're eating free food.
Those long grasses and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is a great time in California.
How is the operation funded then? Is it strictly by donations, or are there some grants and other stuff? And more to the point, what are people listening? Well, how could they, if they felt like, hey, we'd like to send them a few bucks, what's the best way to do that?
Probably the best thing is to go to our website, pawsweb.org.
Right.
See what we do, and if they want to donate something, that would be incredible. Just to keep track of what we're doing, moving into just being the, I'm 73 now, and I had cancer a couple of years ago, and it kind of took a little toll on me.
Oh, geez.
Not horrible. You know, I'm making a pretty decent comeback, but...
Yeah.
But, when I had cancer, I thought, we're going to have to transition here at some point. You know, I mean, Pat has passed away, and I'm thinking, if anything... you know, unexpected happened, we have to have some direction. So I'm the president of the board and still, you know, active and still shoveling elephant poop every morning. But we have added another CEO, you know, to do a lot of the management, and he's a great guy.
Oh, good. Is that Chris Draper or?
Yeah, Chris Draper. He was with Born Free Foundation, and he's got. You've met him.
Yeah,
At our conferences, he's spoken at our conference, and Pat and I were impressed with him a long time ago, and so he's run sanctuaries in Ethiopia and India, but he didn't have elephant experience. He had a wild elephant experience, but not captive.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been, actually, Chris and I've been working together for almost 3.5 years with the elephants.
Oh, that's
and
great.
So he's, and it could, because it's a totally different thing. You know, elephants are kind of a, mystery sometimes and can be overwhelming.
Yeah, very specific kind of needs, I would think, if you're not used to them at all.
Right.
Yeah.
So he's got it now. He's done just about everything you have to do with elephants, and he's shoveled as much as I have in the last couple of years.
Okay. Well, that's the true measure, apparently, probably. Yeah.
So, that is. It actually is.
That's great. So I was going to ask you at one point, we're sort of just about really out of time at this point, but so I was going to ask you a little bit about the future, but it sounds like you kind of answered that in a way by talking about Chris, who's obviously, I guess, as far as the succession plan, the idea is to have him take over.
And you know, I think you've met Brian, who actually was born in Tampa. He's been our elephant manager for 28 years now.
Yeah, he's got the hang of it, I think, at this point. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, and our tiger bear manager's been there 18 years. Our vet has been there 23 years, so you couldn't match the core of people that we have, you know, for experience and knowledge. So
right, but that also speaks to the kind of organization that you and Pat founded and have run ever since. Because you know, there's when you're not seeing any kind of turnover and you're seeing people work that long standing somewhere, that just says this is a great place to work, and the mission is exactly what it should be, and they feel totally committed. So that's super impressive.
Right? Yeah, totally committed. That's the thing. I mean, they anything comes up there, they show up. You know, 2 a.m, everybody's there.
So, yeah, if you need to do something, you need to do something. No one watches the clock, I'm sure. Yeah.
No, not much of that.
Right. So, Ed, we have reached the end of our time, but I really enjoyed speaking to you. This has been Ed Stewart from the Performing Animal Welfare Society, PAWS. And, again, the website is pawsweb.org. You can find out more about some of the things we've been talking about and some of the things we didn't get a chance to talk to. And I'm sorry we didn't. There was a couple of callers that came in kind of at the last minute that I didn't get to take, and an email or two, including about the woolly mammoth question, some other stuff that we'll just have to come back to maybe another time. But, Ed, thank you so much for making the time to join me on Talking Animals. I really appreciate it, and thanks for all your great work over the years.
Well, thank you, Duncan, for having me on.
My pleasure. All right, thanks again, Ed. Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. In a moment, I'll talk with George Heinrich, the reptile expert, field biologist, and environmental educator who will be delivering a lecture coming up Saturday, April 6th, entitled Conserving Wildlife and Wildlines, Building a Career in Herpetology. We'll have that conversation with George in just a moment or two here on Talking Animals. But right now, we're going to step into the Comedy Corner with Paul F. Tompkins and a piece called Alternative Pets in today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
People have their alternative pets on their person. It's people walking around with animals on their body. See a guy that's got an iguana hanging out up there on his shoulder? See another person with a crazy cockatiel? Just hanging out. And I guess you're supposed to have some reaction to these people. You know, I guess what they want you to say is something like, well, pardon me, sir. Is that a bird on your shoulder? Well, you must be one fascinating individual. Your personality is not at all manufactured. I say, what if we were to exchange addresses and became pen pals? That way I could collect your letters in a bound volume entitled My Correspondence with the Most Interesting Person Alive. Working hard for you. That's great. You can have any animal that you want, you know, because we have dominion over the beasts of the fields and all, you know, but here's the thing. Even animals need some alone time, okay? How about that, you know? Maybe the lizard would like to sit at home, play on the rock for a while, you know? Maybe the bird would like to play with the bell, look in the mirror for a little bit. Maybe they don't have to come with you on all your jackass errands. How about that? Leave them alone for a minute. Come on, Cecil, we're going down to the bank so everybody can see your crazy eyes. Woo!
That was Paul F. Tompkins in today's Comedy Corner with a piece called Alternative Pets, taken from his album entitled Impersonal. Now it's time to speak with George Heinrich for, among other things, a sneak preview of the lecture he'll be delivering at Brooker Creek Preserve Environmental Education Center next Saturday, April 6th. So this is George Heinrich back on Talking Animals on WNO. Good morning, George.
Morning, Duncan. Happy birthday.
Oh, thanks. Okay, I thought that was a well-kept secret, but apparently not. So, okay, I appreciate the greetings. Thank you very much. Let's talk, of course, about the lecture in a sec. But for people who maybe think of themselves as indifferent to reptiles, what are they missing from someone that's as passionate about reptiles as you are? What are they failing to appreciate?
I guess their fascinating natural history, various adaptations that they have to live in the different harsh environments that they might occur in. They also have really important ecological roles out there as predators and prey and seed dispersers and so on. So very interesting from a natural history perspective to be able to watch and observe them.
And if you had to say, what's one or two things that you love in particular about reptiles and obviously have for many, many, many years?
I guess the diversity is out there. Uh-huh. I mostly work with turtles, but if I look at them, you know, the different habitats that they live in. So I work with three particular species in the wild. One of them lives in river habitats, another in upland dry habitats, another along the coastal part of Florida. So they're in so many different types of habitats and quite different in their ways that they nest and the seasons they nest and the things that they eat and so on. Of course, what they mostly all have in common is a long list of threats that is a real problem, particularly here in Florida.
Threats to their ongoing survival, you mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Habitat loss and fishery gear and predators and roads and so on.
Yeah. Well, that may bring us to the lecture you're delivering next Saturday, April 6th. So, again, that's at Brooker Creek Preserve Environmental Education Center, and that's next Saturday, April 6th. And the title, I believe, is Conserving Wildlife and Wildlands, Building a Career in Herpetology. So, you know, you don't want to give away too much. Maybe a little sneak preview about what this will cover or maybe one of the stories that you plan to share.
Well, I'm going to be talking about how I make a living as an independent wildlife biologist, so I don't work for any corporations or universities or so on. I'm just an independent researcher and contractor, and I'm going to talk about how an interest in childhood in the New England woods of salamanders and box turtles and so on wove its way through my life, and either while I worked at a zoo while I was in college or with work that I did with the Gopher Tortoise Council for a long time to protect tortoises and uplands and in my summer camp programs and so on. So basically it's just kind of a little look back, I guess, at how I work to try to protect wildlife and wildlands in my various jobs and efforts.
That sounds really cool and fascinating. Is the hope with this lecture, and I guess some of the other things you do that you just referred to cultivate an interest in kids in reptiles that would not be unlike what the interest that you had starting as a kid?
Yeah, my registration material for all of my camps always says on there that we're trying to develop an interest in natural history and hopefully get these kids to get outside and enjoy the outdoors and away from electronics and so on.
You're not telling them to get off their phone, are you, George?
Get off their phone?
Yeah, I'm just kidding. Just all the,
yeah, I mean, turn it off.
Yeah, exactly. There's a reptile here for you to see if you look up from your screen, right? Yeah. So can you describe a little bit, for those who haven't been, the Brooker Creek Preserve Environmental Education Center?
It's a wonderful preserve up located just east of Tarpon Springs with a gorgeous educational building and nice boardwalks and foot trails throughout, so you get to see a number of different habitats. It's real easy to watch reptiles, snakes and turtles and so on in some of the ponds along the trails. And they all have different camps and programs throughout the year. Many of them are sponsored by the Friends of Brooker Creek Preserve, who will be sponsoring the talk that we'll be giving there two Saturdays out. And it's just a great wild place that Pinellas County was smart enough and the citizens supported so that it's protected for hopefully ever.
That's great. All right, George, well, we're out of time, but look forward to that lecture next April. And thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. Appreciate it as always.
Anytime. Thanks for inviting me.
You bet. Thank you. It's Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Up next, A Slice of Life, and then music after that.